Eilif Trondsen, and I'm really happy to bring you another podcast, the seventh in our series for the Nordic EdTech Network project that I lead for Silicon Vikings, a project funded by our friends at Nordic Innovation. In some of my blog posts that some of you might have seen on the project, I made references to one of my favorite educational and EdTech blogs, eLiterate, and I'm really pleased to have Phil Hill and Michael Feldstein, the souls and brains behind the blog and the eLiterate TV, which both offer great analysis, interviews with interesting people, and dealing with a range of leading edge topics and issues in education and learning. So welcome to the podcast, Phil and Michael.
Well, thank you. Looking forward to it.
Great. Well, I think some of our Nordic listeners may not be that familiar with you or with what you are doing and have done with the blog and eLiterate TV. Perhaps you can both take a minute or two to just give a little bit of background for each of you, and then maybe say a little something about, you know, what you cover and focus on and what you like to do in the blog and your video interviews. And do you want to start us off, Phil?
Sure. Yeah. So my background, I've been doing independent consulting in education for about 16 years now. And so I've always sort of fit between educational institutions and the technology they use. So focusing on how do you effectively use the technology. It's not about the features or the software itself, for example, but about what holistic solution a school uses. And I originally did this as just a straight consultant for a while, but I sort of had an itch to get more into public writing, and there was this little blog that was very influential that I was reading, eLiterate, that Michael had started about a dozen years ago, and I sort of forced myself upon him and eventually became co-publisher of the blog. And then we decided to make a business of it. But the blog fits in the same genre. It's how can technology affect teaching and learning, and from a holistic sense, not just what's out there in the market, but how do schools use it? What are the organizational issues that we face? And what are the trends? Where do we see things going in the future? Right. And hopefully we take a position of, we present what is in a very clarifying way, and that includes the positive and the negative, because we think you can learn from both. But so now Michael and I were doing consulting, we're doing blogging, and we have market analysis business as well, all focused on the same general theme.
Great. Okay, Michael, do you want to say a little bit about your background and have anything to add to what Phil said about what you guys are up to?
Sure. So I have a fairly eclectic background, but I always think of myself as a teacher from a family of teachers,
right,
even though it's been a while since I worked in the classroom. I did teach middle school and high school, and so that would be grades 8 through 12 for international listeners. And I went to graduate school in English literature, but I spent a fair number of years as a corporate e-learning consultant. I started the blog, as Phil said, about a dozen years ago when I made the transition back to where my heart was, which was education. At the time, it was higher education, so I worked at the State University of New York supporting the development of technology-enabled courses across State University of New York is a huge system. There are 64 colleges and universities in the system across the state of New York, and so we worked with the majority of them.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I went and I worked for a number of different vendors in the space. I worked at Oracle. I worked at Cengage Learning, which is a large textbook publisher, always focusing on how technology can improve teaching and learning. And then, as Phil said, we found each other first as bloggers and then as business partners, and it's been good ever since.
Great. Yeah, it's been great for all of us. I really enjoy reading what you guys do, and keeps me updated on what's happening around. And in these podcasts, I like to look a little bit back to review some things that have happened and what they mean. And in this case, of course, for the Nordic EdTech entrepreneurs, especially those who are, you know, there are more and more of them now that have global ambitions and need to know about what is happening, particularly in the big markets around the world. And then later in this podcast, we can go get back and look at forward a little bit, some of the things that are coming. So if you look back at the year that is now almost over, perhaps you could highlight a couple of things, a couple of developments that you see out there in the education industry, either in the K through 12 or higher ed, that you think have had significant impact on the current edtech markets, or will perhaps have a significant impact in the next couple of years or so. So do you want to start with that, Michael?
Sure. These markets always move a lot more slowly than we imagine they will or want them to or hope they will. Right now, the two real dominant features in educational technology are the learning management system, of course, which has evolved over the last, I guess we can say 20 years now, and probably more depending on your definition of when they started, but 20 years of commercial learning management systems, but not dramatically, really, and a lot of the most important evolutions have been subtle. Ease of use, reliability, moving to the cloud, which just makes the system hopefully more reliable and easier to keep up to date, increasing usability, that sort of thing. Here in the North American market, in the U.S. and Canada at least, the market is very saturated. All of these schools use learning management systems, and more and more we're seeing not only that every school has one, but that faculty, more and more professors use them in meaningful ways. And of course, there's LMSs worldwide. The level of adoption and the depth of use varies very much from country to country, but it's still pretty much the dashboard through which most things happen. And I'd say, following behind that is digital courseware. As textbook publishers are discovering that, on the one hand, paper textbooks and just publishing flat, non-interactive content is becoming less and less of a viable business for them, or at least less and less of a profitable business for them. They are forced to look to other options. But on the other hand, digital enables them to solve problems for teachers and students that they couldn't solve with paper. And so there's certainly not the same level of market penetration as the LMS, but we're starting to see increasingly broad use and acceptance of these digital products. So those are probably the two major pillars right now of where educational technology is evolving, and then there are lots of conversations we can have about trends that are on the horizon, like learning analytics, adaptive learning, competency-based education, Phil and I tend to take a skeptical eye toward all these trends. Not that we doubt, well, sometimes we doubt their value, but more often it's a question of how long it takes for these things to be adopted in meaningful and useful ways. And right now I'd call all three of those topics pretty early on, early stage.
Right. Okay. Well, Phil, in addition to those that Michael pointed out there, are there some things that you see out there that the Nordic EdTech entrepreneur should pay special attention to, especially if they get serious about entering into the U.S. market, but maybe even make some comments about some of the opportunities in Europe, because I know you published a report recently on that. You're expanding your global horizons to look more at what's happening outside the U.S. So you want to say a few words about some of the things that you see?
Sure. One thing that seems to be happening broad-based, and it's good and bad, it goes back to that time element that Michael mentioned. On the bad side, you know, there's always sort of the markets never move as quickly as people hope. So right. There's a big issue about stability of vendors, having a revenue model, a funding model in place to be able to survive the reality of the market compared to the marketing or the hype of the market. But within that vein, one of the big things that we're seeing is there's been less hype lately, certainly in terms of we're not looking at MOOCs, massive open online courses, completely changing education the way some people were claiming 3 or 4 years ago. And then there's been some learning analytics that people just made it sound like these algorithms would solve everything. I've seen a relaxation in the hype. And one of the good aspects of that is we're seeing in the U.S. certainly that colleges and universities are taking more control of their own destiny. They're becoming more active participants in what kind of ed tech do we want moving forward and how will we apply it.
Right.
And a simple thing, online program management, where for-profit companies help schools develop online programs, has been a growing market in the U.S. and starting to be outside of the U.S. But we're also seeing a move now where schools are saying, hey, a lot of this stuff we can do on our own. We only want certain services to help us go online. We want to own this core part of course design or even marketing. So schools slowly taking more ownership of the changes enabled by digital learning is a big trend. It can be frustrating and take a lot longer than we wish, but I see that as sort of one of these mega trends that's going to have a long-lasting impact over the next decade or more. And one other thing I would mention, Michael talked about the LMS in terms of a dashboard, sort of an entry point into ed tech, if you will. And that's certainly true. And part of what's happening is there's more activity outside the LMS that quite often happens because of the LMS or it gets enabled. But this situation of sort of these third-party learning applications and analytics for faculty and students and a variety of things, a lot of them are very compelling. But we're just now starting to deal with, well, what does that mean, particularly in terms of privacy? You know, if you have a free application that individual faculty can choose and it might not go through a typical procurement process, well, who's saying whether the company is handling the student data in a way that matches, forget the U.S. or Canadian laws, that matches the requirements in the European Union in particular?
Right.
And so this is good and bad. It's a richer set of choices available, but it's opening up some of these issues. How do you deal with this when it's not all a big procurement effort? And
right.
So that's, I'd say that particularly, I think companies, Scandinavian companies, any company getting into the space, better have a good answer on how they're protecting student data, because it might be a little bit open right now, but schools are starting to notice and push back. So student data privacy is a big trend that I would make sure that people keep in mind.
I don't know if both of you have followed the Uninet procurement, but I know you and I have talked about that, Phil, and what is happening in Norway. And I think, I don't know if they actually selected a vendor yet or that's about to happen, but I was curious whether the Norwegian process, if that's something we're likely to see in the rest of the Nordics, and particularly what that might mean to smaller companies, and that relates to the LMS discussion we just had. You know, if that's the entry point, and of course there are some larger players in the LMS space, but most of the Nordic edtech companies that I'm dealing with are not in the LMS space. They're providing a variety of other products and services. So can they play with the LMSs? And of course, one implication that they have to think about then is the data, the protection on the data you mentioned, Phil. But are there other things that, what kind of observation can you make for about the smaller companies in this space and what the implications for them is of some of these things?
Sure. And full disclosure for your listeners, Uninet is a subscriber to our European LMS, to our LMS market subscription, and we gave them some additional advice on their process. So I can't really, I have to be careful and not speak from any inside information. So my comments will be more broad-based for the Nordic countries. You have an interesting situation, particularly that we're seeing more and more, where the procurement directive, the EU procurement directives, are driving a lot of how these activities go on. And so we're seeing more and more of consortia-based approaches, mm-hmm. where individual schools, it's just not feasible or it's very difficult for them to make ed tech decisions in a cost-effective way that complies with the EU procurement directives. So when you have a consortium like Uninet that can go through the process and meet all the requirements and enable a collection of schools to work together, we're seeing more of that type of activity moving forward in Europe in particular, more so than in North America. But that brings up an interesting question that you're alluding to is, well, what about the the smaller players? Because it is true that if you sort of do more centralization of some of the procurements, there's going to be a natural tendency to go towards, well, which companies can prove that they can serve multiple institutions, not just right. one at a time.
Right.
And it raises this interesting dilemma, and I don't think it where small companies might have trouble bidding. They might not have the staff to be able to write these big proposals based on the tender. And they might be disqualified because they can't show that they can serve across an entire country. And I think that is a difficult situation that it's incumbent not just on the vendors themselves, but also on the consortia and on the schools to make sure that they don't go too far that mm-hmm. they hamper innovation in the market. Now, in the short term, what that means is smaller ed tech vendors have to be clever. Either you're going to have to invest and make sure that you can respond to these tenders and write large proposals, or you're going to need to find ways to do some clever partnerships, latching on to an LMS vendor or something else to make sure that you can be small and innovative, but you can still respond to more of the consortia. Not everything's a consortia, but it's sort of the trend that we're seeing and an open issue, particularly for smaller ed tech vendors.
Right. Yeah, let me follow up a little bit on that, but put Michael on the spot. And I know Michael, actually, you, both of you, I think, have written on adaptive learning and adaptive versus personalized and that whole debate. And I think there's a little bit of confusion out there in the marketplace, thinking that those two are equal, but not getting too much into that, I know in Norway, one of the largest publishing company, Gyldendal, is working with Newton. And I'm wondering if that also means that the smaller players are going to be kind of left out because, Newton is a fairly large player, or it's certainly getting to be bigger. And what do you see? Could you follow up a little bit, Michael, on what you see on the analytics side and what this might mean in terms of either opportunities or threats for some of these smaller players out there?
Sure. I wouldn't take any Newton announcement or any large vendor announcement in this space to be too meaningful at this point. It's early days, and for a lot of companies that are especially legacy textbook publishers who want to get into the world of educational technology but don't necessarily have particular in-house capabilities, and I don't know the Nordic textbook market, so I can't speak to the individual capabilities of your companies. But in general, textbook publishers have not been technology vendors, so they often will partner in early stage with a company like Newton that has some capabilities and expertise that they don't. But you brought up the distinction between personalized learning and adaptive learning, and I think it's worth talking at a very, very high level about that because it pertains both to your current question and to the one you asked Phil. We make a distinction between innovations that are focused on teaching practices and product innovations that support those teaching practices. So adaptive learning for us is a set of product capabilities that respond to certain student input. Could be a test answer or time on task or any one of a number of factors by changing the way it works, by interpreting the student's needs and changing the way it works accordingly.
Right.
Personalized learning is a set of strategies employed by the teacher to differentiate instruction based on the student's individual needs. And adaptive learning is an adaptive learning tool is one of the enabling capabilities that a teacher might use to achieve that.
Right.
Now, the real challenge is, and this is one of the reasons why EdTech moves so slowly, most teachers, whether you're talking about higher education or primary and secondary, they aren't necessarily trained in some of these capabilities yet. More so in higher education, where certainly in North America and in many parts of the world, the instructors are not trained on teaching capabilities. They're trained on their subject.
Right.
And so changing their strategies, their teaching strategies, is asking a lot from them. They weren't taught how to do that. They don't necessarily think that way. They often are not compensated in a way that encourages them to explore new pedagogies. And so what that means is that the pace of adoption of something like adaptive learning is going to be limited by the capabilities of faculty to learn how to deliver effective personalized learning, learn how to teach in that way. And that means vendors large and small that figure out how to partner with faculty to help them embrace these new teaching approaches, to think about this as professional development, as something that's going to make their teaching lives better, are going to be companies that succeed. And it also means that consortia, like the ones that Phil was talking about, are opportunities for educators to begin to share best practices across departments and institutions. And that's a real opportunity. In a way, if you have a well-functioning consortium and you're able to come in as an entrepreneur and offer teachers, faculty, a way of improving their teaching experience and their student outcomes in a way that's enticing to them, then being able to amplify that across a consortium is a really positive development.
Right. Yeah. In fact, some of that, I think, would be of great interest to a Finnish entrepreneur I had a meeting with just yesterday. There are quite a few Nordic edtech companies that are into the, at least intrigued by opportunities around using games in learning, so gamification or game-based learning. And I know there are a number of Finnish companies, including the one that I talked to yesterday. This company was also behind the Minecraft EDU that, of course, has had some significant impact out there. But let me refer to another Norwegian company. I'm Norwegian, so I have to mention the company Kahoots, because I was interviewing Michael Staten of Learn Capital a few months back, and he was amazed at the impressive growth rate that this Norwegian company has had in terms of user acquisition in North America. And he said he was not aware of anyone that had grown more rapidly than they have. I think he was only talking about users and maybe not in revenues yet, but I think they've been making some progress on monetizing what they are doing. And I'm not sure if you are familiar with Kahoots, but they use gaming methods and allowing students even to come up with questions that they make and pose to other students and so on. So I hope to interview them, but they have had success. And based on that, I was wondering if the two of you, based on what you have seen smaller companies do, if you have maybe a few do's or don'ts that our Nordic EdTech listeners should think about as they look ahead, and particularly to the U.S. market and entry into this market, which is, you know, a huge market, but also very complex. So any observations you could make would be appreciated there, and maybe you want to start with that, Michael?
Well, just following up on my last answer, I would say do think about faculty incentives and right. about faculty education. There is a strong trend, and this will be paired with the don't, which is don't become so focused on personalized learning and student-centered learning that you forget about the teacher.
Right.
There are exceptions to every rule. I think entrepreneurs tend to be attracted to the consumer model because it's worked so well in other spaces. And there certainly are models and markets where products that sell directly to students without any involvement of the teacher can be very successful. I am not personally familiar with Kahoots, so I can't speak to it, even whether it fits this model or why it's successful. But by and large, I think entrepreneurs tend to underestimate the value of making friends with the faculty and the administrators. There's a tendency to paint them as bureaucratic obstacles, institutional, all the kinds of things that get in the way of change and innovation. But actually, these are very passionate people, and they do share with their colleagues. If you can get faculty excited about your product, they're very good at affinity marketing. So right. I would focus on the needs of the students. Obviously, outcomes are the name of the game, but focus on how you can help faculty see themselves as being more effective, and being able to focus more of their jobs on the high value and high enjoyment aspects of teaching, like helping students become passionate about the subjects that they themselves are passionate about.
Right. Do you want to add a little bit to that, Phil? Some of the things that you see that, in terms of do's and don'ts for the Nordic EdTech entrepreneurs as they look at the North America particularly?
Sure. I guess I would add two things. One is, we have a theme that we've had throughout this conversation talking about integrating it with faculty and the changes in teaching styles and how that takes some real effort. But if you look at that from a positive, I can see some small companies saying, oh my gosh, I just don't have time or patience or the ability to do that. But if you look at the flip side of that coin, a lot of these big companies, and you mentioned learning analytics in some areas, a lot of these big companies don't have a lot of proof points themselves. So I would encourage companies to say, if you can work tightly with a particular school or program or a particular application and really make it successful, partner completely with the institution and the teacher and show some really good outcomes, a small number of case studies can go a long way in this market, since we're in the early stage of a lot of the non-LMS learning applications. Yeah. So really looking at proof points, even a small number, can really take you far. And the second thing I would add is, if you're looking to break into the U.S., don't just look at the U.S. as a very large number of people with funny accents and underused passports, but look at the education market as a set of academic disciplines. Because when we talk about affinity marketing, quite a lot of that, at least within the U.S., will happen within biology circles or within developmental mathematics circles or, other academic disciplines. So take advantage, if you're going into the U.S., take advantage of our size by being able to choose the right disciplines and the right context where you can succeed and really come up with compelling case studies that people will believe, and they can call their colleagues and say, hey, did this really happen? And they can say, I'm seeing the results. And so think of that type of specialization as a real opportunity here.
Yeah, that's very good advice, Phil. I totally agree with that, and I think that makes it a little easier to think about this huge market if you can, segment it into particular domains, whether it's mathematics or biology or physics or chemistry. A lot of ways to cut to slice this up and make it more manageable, and where you can really show having an impact. But I think we're getting close to the end here, and I don't want to leave you without giving you a chance to speculate a little bit and put on your futures hat. So particularly now we're getting a new administration. A lot of changes might be coming in the U.S., but who knows what the Trump administration will bring us. But anyway, maybe each of you could look ahead a little bit in the next 2 to 3 years. What are some of the things that you would recommend that the Nordic EdTech entrepreneur should think about or look out for? Or so it could be either in terms of an opportunity or a threat out there because of what is brewing in the U.S. In the next 3 to 4 years. So Michael, do you want to, since Phil just talked, maybe Michael want to finish off on that?
Yeah, sure. I'm going to avoid making any predictions about the Trump administration because there's a well-worn track record now of everyone being wrong about everything about the guy.
Yeah, that is true.
So I don't understand anything about Donald Trump and won't pretend to have anything to say about it. But what I will say is that the next few years, just adding up all the things that we've been talking about, the next few years, I think, we're really starting to see a turn, in part for demographic reasons, in the U.S. towards more deeper engagement among faculty with educational technology. There are some institutional and state and federal drivers like funding that's more tied to outcomes. That definitely has had a big impact. But also, you're just getting more young faculty who've grown up with technology,
right,
and are more comfortable with it naturally. That's going to differ dramatically from country to country. So in Italy, for example, where the retirement rate, the federal pension rate, age cutoff was raised, and they have a very old average K through 12 teaching population. And so the rate of change there is going to be affected by when those older teachers retire and make room for younger teachers who have different technology habits. But right now, I think what we're seeing is for the first time at both the institutional level and at the individual faculty level, a real engagement with what can we do with this stuff. And to Phil's earlier point, they're going to be looking for proof points. I don't think we're going to see any big revolution, disruption, some fantastic new technology that's going to change everything. This is more like the 30 years it took in the early 20th century after all of the major medical discoveries of the 19th century, germ theory, viruses, anesthesia. It took another three decades and a lot of investment to get medical schools to turn out physicians who were using science-based practices. And we're really at the beginning of that slope right now. We're at the beginning of the slope of change where teachers and faculty begin to use science-based practices to teach. And so that's where the money's going to be. It's going to be in enabling that change.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much. Phil, do you want to have a few concluding remarks looking ahead?
One other aspect I guess I would add to this is, since we expanded our LMS market subscription to Europe and have done more analysis of what's happening in Europe, it gave a lot more of a firsthand or secondhand view of how there's becoming more of a global ed tech market in much more significant way than there has been in the past. Is you're seeing a lot more cross-pollination of ideas between Nordic countries and the U.S., both directions. They have different time frames of when they adopt things, but if you sort of look within, say, a three-year time period, we're seeing more and more where common technologies, common vendor solutions, but more importantly, common teaching practices are starting to get shared across multiple markets, particularly in this case talking about Nordic and North American markets. And I expect that's going to be to a greater degree than it has in the past, and it's going to affect the opportunity for companies and schools to share ideas and products across regional boundaries. And to me, that's a positive outcome if it really keeps going in that direction. But I think it's another one of these longer-term trends that I think will have an impact. And a lot of this speaks to patients. I think there's a lot of significant trends going on in ed tech right now. We've talked about quite a few of them. But in almost every case, it's a matter of patience. Things don't change as quickly as some people hope, but they are going through these big fundamental changes at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope that most of the Nordic EdTech companies that I deal with can have the patience and have the patient funding so they can stay around until these opportunities materialize. You know, funding is always an issue. And I think that's one of the many issues we'll be talking about at our conference in June in Kristiansand, just like we did last year. So anyway, I want to thank both of you. This has been really interesting, and I think our Nordic EdTech entrepreneurs out there have gained a number of things to think about as they plan their strategies for the next few years. So thank you very much to both of you. Really appreciate your participation in the podcast. Take care.
All right. Thank you, Ida.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.